We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, water, and sky country on which this podcast was developed, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging.
In case you hadn't noticed, one's happiness doesn't last very long, and you can't hang on to it. It's quite quickly torn apart by the forces of the world, and ideally, will be sent into the underworld, fermented, and will return again, make another epiphany.
Dionysus, the forgotten god, was a workshop given to the C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne by Robert Johnson in 1985. My name is Dana Kabila, and welcome to Season 4 of the podcast. The C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne offers a space for the communication, exploration, and development of Jungian ideas and practices. The Society conducts a monthly virtual lecture, offers a selection of short courses, and houses a specialist Jungian library for use by its members. This talk discusses myths of the complex and fragile god Dionysus, born of both parents and a third time born of the underworld, both the last Olympian and the first to be cast out, where the qualities of his brother Apollo fit more easily into a patriarchal framework, the qualities of Dionysus as the sensuous god are often rejected by the Western world. The speaker for this podcast episode is the late Robert Johnson. A popular author and speaker, Robert completed his analytical training at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, with Emma Jung as his principal analyst. Over his life, he worked as an Episcopal priest, Jungian analyst, and authored many books, offering Jungian interpretation in accessible language. In 2002, he received an honorary doctorate in humanities and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Last night we observed the Chinese proclivity for ambiguity or paradox in their language. Most of that has been filtered out of our Western tongues. We like clarity, we like directness in our language, so that something means exactly what it says. But there are a few of those paradoxical elements remaining in our language, and one of them is useful for us this afternoon. And that is the double meaning of the word whole. The noble meaning of the word is the completeness or the roundness or the totality. And if one were to describe Jungian psychology in a single word, it would be to speak of the wholeness of life. Well, the other possible meaning of the word is that which you fall into, a hole, H-O-L-E, which one can easily fall into, disappear. And it's just a nice, paradoxical, powerful fact that if you want to be whole, W-H-O-L-E, one of the quickest ways you can pursue it is to find the holes in your life, H-O-L-E. This is very painful, and it's guaranteed to set one into a crisis immediately if you have the courage to search out the holes of your life. But it's required if you want the wholeness of your life. We're going to examine one of those holes, culturally speaking, which our Western world, and especially the English-speaking world, has in it. Just between the sensation function and the feeling function in Western man, especially English-speaking Western man, there's a terrible hole. And we keep falling into this abyss. We tumble headfirst into it. We have so many cultural devices for avoiding that hole or covering it or playing as if it weren't there. The feeling function is difficult for us. We have not developed very well in the feeling department. We are uneasy with it. We will allow feelings if they are discreet and careful and nice and well contained. As for the sensation function, nice people don't indulge in it. I wasn't aware of how much I had been trained out of the sensation function by my Western Christian Protestant background until I was in the Muslim world last summer. I found the amazing fact, for instance, that if I kept farther than 6 inches away from the face of a Muslim friend when I was talking with him, I was announcing publicly that I disliked him. If one gets within 6 inches of a good Anglo-Saxon, he begins to back off from one, feels as if his space is being invaded. The Muslim world, which is an extroverted sensation world and religion, to touch, to be close, to caress, to be physically intimate, is a high virtue, just the reverse of our Protestant Christian background. And I realized only then that I had been taught that I earned my way into heaven by subduing the sensation world. The less I had to do with the senses of my body, the less I had to do with the thingness of the world, the more virtuous I was. And what an astounding experience it was to live briefly in a culture where the thingness of the world is one's entree into heaven. We are particularly inept in the sensation function. We have the unspoken assumption or training that to limit the sensation function is the highest virtue. Heaven is to be gained by subduing the sensuous world. Dr. Jung has observed that the Western Christian Church, though not the Eastern Orthodox churches, unconsciously announces this imbalance by making one of the arms of the cross longer than the others. He says that the sensation member of the cross, the bottom one, is lengthened in Western Christianity to compensate for the downgrading of the senses in our theological attitudes. Now, the Greek Orthodox Church and others of the Eastern Church have not done this. They have not downgraded the sense world, so they have an equal armed cross. But just in between these two faculties, feeling and sensation, is the whole which we're going to talk about. And that is the quality of Dionysus, the Greek god of ecstasy, the Greek god of the sensuous world. As I talk about this, I will use a pronunciation which is most commonly used in the Jungian world. There are other pronunciations available, and I won't quarrel with anyone who finds a different pronunciation of these various Greek gods. Example of the uneasiness around this hole in our culture. Soon after the passing of the peace was instituted in the Episcopal Church, which was a bold thing to do, I was in my beloved Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, a great Gothic building in San Francisco, which has been a kind of pilgrimage place to me ever since my teens. It's the only great Gothic building in Western America. I was luxuriating in the music and the greatness of that wonderful, soaring, sublime building. The altar boys brought the piece down from the altar and with white-gloved hands brought it to each person at the end of the pew for the whole length of the church, and it was then passed down the pew to each member as a handshake. The piece was brought to the end of the pew where I was sitting. It was passed along. The woman to my right turned around to me with an anguished look in her face and with a gloved hand reached out her little finger to me. She was embarrassed at the touch of a stranger. No sensation function possible there. I didn't know what to do, so I reached out with my two fingers, and we shook hands like this. And the embarrassment that was generated between us was just something frightful. I was observing, here is the whole. I don't very often get angry, and when I do, it's over some ridiculous small thing which is of no consequence. But I got angry at that moment. So I turned around, stood up, pulled the man who was on the other side of me to his feet, gave him a great bear hug, and sat him down again. The poor man was so completely disorganized by this that he sat down looking straight ahead, and the piece went no farther down the pew. This is what happens to good Anglo-Saxon people when they're in the presence of that whole which we're talking about. I think this lecture began on that Sunday morning. This particular place, that which is shared between the feeling function and the sensation function, is the realm of the god Dionysus, the god of ecstasy, the god of sensation, the god of revelry, the god of enthusiasm, and if one can use the word in its original meaning, which is worship, it is the god of orgy. Orgy originally meant to worship. The word has been perverted. Now we'll use it in its old, original sense. Dionysus was the last god to be elevated to Mount Olympus in Greek mythology, and he was the first to be torn down when Olympus was dismantled, which shows how fragile he is. I can make only one analogy, which I know of, to this. A faculty which is most recently added to human faculty is the one that's most often missing or is the most fragile. The color blue, apparently, was the last major faculty to be added to the human race. The word blue does not turn up in the Old Testament at any point. And none of the historical writings, Homer, for instance, ever speaks of the color blue. The theory being that the human eye was not yet capable of registering the color blue. Homer, for instance, speaks of the Aegean Sea, the bluest ocean in the world, as the wine-dark sea. There simply was not the faculty to see blue. So it's not surprising, then, that blue is the most often missing in colorblindness of all the colors in our color sense. Exactly so with Dionysus, the god of revelry and ecstasy. He was the last faculty to be raised to godhood. He was the first to be torn down, and he is the most fragile of all of our faculties now. So you begin to see the proportion of what we're going to talk about this afternoon. Who is this fragile god? What does he mean? What does he do? And how do we relate to him? The answer is badly. When I tell you the story of how Dionysus was born, you won't be surprised at the fragility of this god. I'm using the word god in the Greek sense of one of the interior faculties, an archetype in cooler, more modern language. Dionysus came into existence in the following way, which is just an incredible story. One wonders how he made it at all. Zeus in disguise, and the word means giver of light. was sojourning in disguise, incognito, on the face of the earth, and he fell in love with a mortal woman, Semele. We courted Semele, and soon Semele was with child. Semele, realizing that she had an extraordinary spouse, one day asked Zeus for a boon. And Zeus, being in a mood, and moods are as difficult for the gods as they are for mortals, agreed. And Semele said, "I want to see you in your true splendor." And Zeus said, "Good God, no, ask anything, but don't ask that, because you couldn't stand it. There's no way. Please ask anything else, but don't ask me that." Semele persisted, and she said, "I want to see you in your true godlike splendor." Zeus said, "No way. You couldn't stand it." But Semele persisted, and finally Zeus, being true to his word, showed himself in his true shower of light, or giver of light, aspect. And Semele was almost totally, instantly incinerated. No mortal can stand the full impact of the splendor of God. Our own scripture tells us it is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Well, it's a terrible thing to have the Zeus splendor suddenly blasted into one's face. Mortal can't stand it. Semele was incinerated, all except for a small portion of her midriff, around which she had wrapped some vines of ivy leaves, because vine and ivy is impervious to the splendor of God. So that part of her was saved. Zeus was angry because he didn't want his son, who is Dionysus, to be killed. So he quickly cut an incision in his own thigh, took the unborn baby from Semele's almost incinerated body, tucked it into his own thigh, sewed it up, and gestated the child for the 3 remaining months of its life, and then gave birth to it himself. Well, with a start like that, what do you expect? I had a wonderful experience once. I climbed one of the great mountains of India, a temple on the top of it, on which stood a sculpture 70 feet and 2 inches in height of the god Gaumata, who in a later incarnation, at the time of Buddha, founded the Jain, J-A-I-N, religion, still known in India. Here's this great colossal statue. He is so high and so big that his toenails are just exactly the right height for altarpieces. So the ceremony to Gaumata is performed on his toenails. And beside this, a human-sized sculpture standing beside one of his toes, about the same height, there's a lovely, lovely, great-breasted, buxom woman carved in stone, a voluptuous figure. I asked my friend Ambashankar, "Who is the goddess?" And he said, "Oh, I have to inform you that that is a god." And I said, "Well, please explain now." And he said, "Before the fall of man, both the father and the mother breastfed the baby, and that's how a hero is born." I was very sober because I'd heard something of very great depth and power. If you wish to nurture the heroic side of yourself or your son, you must breastfeed it from both the father and the mother, meaning from both the masculine and the feminine side, and that produces a hero. One day I'm going to do a lecture on just that subject because it thrills me so much. If you're looking at the raising of your own son, remember this. Because if you wish to instill a heroic element into him, he must be nourished both by his father and his mother, not just one. That's portrayed in this old myth, by the gestation of Dionysus, first in his mother's body and later in his father's body. Then he is given birth. He's an androgynous god, and he's one of the gods who arrived full-blown, full-grown, part masculine, part feminine, functioning immediately upon birth. Well, there are two stories of what happened to him, both of them sad. Qualities as sublime and beautiful and profound as this don't function very well on the face of the earth. One story is that the Titans heard of the birth of this extraordinary god and came rushing and tore Dionysus apart immediately. And he was translated into Hades, the underworld, and fermented like grapes and turned into wine, and he reappeared on the face of the earth as the wine god, which he is. Another story is that Dionysus, being particularly beloved of women, was adopted as the center of the women's mysteries of Eleusis. The women, nobody knows what they did, but they went into a kind of ecstatic state somehow or another. And the story is that they got excessive in their Dionysian revelries and actually tore their god to pieces with their fingers and sent him into the underworld, where he was fermented like the grape and reappeared on the face of the earth as wine. He is the wine god, he is the god of ecstasy, he is the god of that which is greater than oneself. He's the god of revelry, he's the god of enthusiasm and orgy in its original meaning. It's said of Dionysus that he has made more epiphanies, the word meaning to show forth, than any other of the gods. We commonly use the term twice born in Christianity. Are you born again? One speaks of the twice born man. Well, Dionysus is the thrice born god, three times, because he was born of his mother, he was born of his father, and then he was born of the underworld as wine. He is the god of happiness, and it doesn't take much effort to see that one's happiness is suffering much the same fate as Dionysus himself. In case you hadn't noticed, one's happiness doesn't last very long, and you can't hang on to it. It's quite quickly torn apart by the forces of the world, and ideally will be sent into the underworld, fermented, and will return again, make another epiphany. And this is the correct relationship or attitude toward happiness. Let it have its time, brief probably. Let it go into the underworld. Let it ferment and distill itself, and it will come back again. And this is the nature of epiphany, of happiness, or the principle, or the god of happiness within one. We've misused the word Hades. We have subverted it into our own use. But in Greek times, Hades was the earth god and was a god of richness and good fortune. So to send something to Hades is to send it to that place of richness where distillation may take place. And that which is sent into the underworld will come back refreshed or distilled and bring another flood of happiness for one. Dionysus, as we noted, is especially beloved of women. He is the only god who never quarreled with his wife. Quite a feat. Dionysus got drunk only once in his life. He is the god of wine, but with one exception, he never misused this. Unfortunately, the Roman world got hold of Dionysus and turned him into Bacchus, the god of drunkenness. And there were such excesses, and it was so misused a faculty, that in the year 181 BC, the Roman Senate banned the Bacchanalia, which was the festival of Bacchus, the wine god. And Dionysus has not been seen in polite company ever since. He went underground. Dionysus did get drunk once. There are two versions of that story, neither very flattering to us. Dionysus was scheduled to go to his father's temple, to Zeus's temple, and he got so frightened that he drank too much and got roaring drunk. And one story is that on his way to the shrine, he fell into quicksand and would have died, except that a donkey came along and fished him out, hoisted him onto his back, and delivered him roaring drunk to Zeus's shrine, for which Zeus gave thanks to the donkey by giving him human speech. The other version is that Dionysus turned into a donkey himself and arrived at his father's shrine, braying like a donkey, which is the origin of human speech. I like the latter version better because it fits me more accurately. Whenever I get into an inflation or a drunkenness of any sort, and there are many, many ways of doing it, my speech takes on particular accents of donkey braying. We spoke a great deal last evening about the meaning of ecstasy in one's life, that capacity for standing outside of oneself, for finding that which is greater than oneself, simply to be blasted out of one's littleness. And Dionysus is the god of ecstasy. His twin brother, Apollo, gives the Apollonian quality, which is discipline and virtue and responsibility, power, those noble masculine qualities. And they're admirable qualities. We can't do without them. But after some hours of Apollonian quality, of responsibility and discipline and focusedness, one can't stand it anymore, and one needs a little bit of the other of the equation. One needs a bit of Dionysus. And by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, one is very tired of responsibility and discipline, and he very often retires to the cocktail lounge for the happy hour or the tea break in order to refresh oneself with some of the stuff of Dionysus. If one observes our customs of crowning the victor with the laurel leaves of Apollo, it's only a few minutes after such a ceremony that Dionysus is in order and one goes off to drink or have a toast or the relaxation of the evening. Discipline and Dionysus are a pair of opposites, and they need each other desperately. And it's a good arrangement of life if, when one has had an Apollonian victory, to go immediately and pay service to the god Dionysus. When you are focused, then it is good to go into the ecstatic world, which is its opposite. A very curious custom. How does one conjure up Dionysus? And the Greek prescription for this is a very strange one, and you have to hang on now for a minute in this description. The goat, which we will speak of much more later on, is the animal of Dionysus. And the prescription for the Dionysian orgy or quality, orgy in its original meaning of to worship, is this. Take a kid, kill it, cut it into 7 pieces, stew it in its mother's milk, and eat it. This is the Dionysian communion. First of all, it's the goat, the young goat. The goat was designated as the animal of Dionysus, probably because, as anybody who knows about goats will observe, the goat, especially a young one, will suddenly be taken over by what seems to be a fit, and it will jump. Its hindquarters will be up level with its front quarters suddenly. And this capricious movement, and capricious comes from the word capri, goat. So it was thought that the goat, in its ecstatic jumping about, its irrationality, was overtaken by Dionysus and was the animal of Dionysus. So the Greeks felt, prescribed, that if you take a kid, kill it, cut it up, and seethe it, seethe, an old word for stew or boil, it in its mother's milk and eat it, this would bring the Dionysian ecstatic quality to you. One eats the flesh of the goat for Dionysus. We eat the flesh of the slain lamb for our Apollonian festivals. To stew something in its mother's milk means to return it to the Garden of Eden, to take it back into its childhood, to take it back into its non-conscious realm, and to bring it to that level which was before time began, to make an aboriginal of it, aboriginal meaning before the beginning, of consciousness. Well, this is a curious prescription. I think I understand it reasonably well. But a very curious offshoot came from this. If you'll read in the book of Leviticus, it says, thou shalt not seethe a kid in its mother's milk, which most people pass by and wonder what's that curious statement there for. Well, this is what's in back of it, and it's of tremendous and direct importance to us now. The Jewish world decided to make a purely patriarchal world back 2000 BC or some such time as that. And they knew that if they were to make a patriarchal world, they would have to set the whole Dionysian principle aside, so that the patriarchy could come to the high development, which it in fact did. So their prescription is no Dionysian quality whatsoever, so that the Apollonian patriarchal quality could come to a high level of development. And this is our direct lineage to this day. Our religious life prescribes for us that we may have no Dionysian quality. Thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk in any way in our conduct or in our attitude. In an Orthodox Jewish household, to this day, there are two sets of crockery, silverware, and even dishpan. And anything that is involved with meat is used with one set of utensils, even to the dishpan. And anything that's involved with milk uses the other set, even down to the dishpan, so that there would be no possibility whatsoever that the kid might meet its own mother's milk, because the Dionysian thing might come in and the whole patriarchal world would come down with a crash. This is our heritage. From our Judeo-Christian background, this is what we are taught. And though nobody knows anything about this anymore, and none of you are likely to have two sets of crockery in the house, still, psychologically speaking, we keep the kid separate from its mother's milk so that we won't go off into that Dionysian state, which is forbidden in a patriarchal culture. This is of most profound and deep significance for us as people. When I tell you an hour from now what happens to the banished Dionysus in our psychology, you'll see the depths of importance of this step in our spiritual history. I think probably this was a good move to make, and I'm not pointing out a fault, I'm simply pointing out a fact. if we are to engage in the patriarchal culture which we have, and which is the envy of the third world countries these days, it is won and gained at the cost of banishing Dionysus from us. This is what we have paid for it. I think it was worth it. I'm not complaining. But it's good to know what we paid for it, so that we might make that payment consciously and not get lost in the unconscious symptomatic payments which are endemic with us now. The banished Dionysian quality is returning to our society now, whether we like it or not, and he seems to have chosen Southern California as his chief epiphany. I live in the midst of 100, if not 1,000 experiments on how to restore Dionysus. You can go dancing nude on Black's Beach at full moon. You can have your choice of half a dozen seminars any weekend on how to loosen up and let the Dionysian quality flow into your life. There's speaking in tongues. There is revelry. There is, you know all the things that are going on. I spent a weekend a couple of weeks ago in the Rebirthing Center near Sydney, and Dionysus is the ruling god. One hyperventilates until all of the Apollonian quality is suddenly thrown off, and the whole Dionysian world comes pouring out of one. There are many ways. Good heavens, self-bribery. I'll have to think about that. I wonder if one has to bribe Apollo in order to get a little Dionysus. Maybe that's the bribery which goes on. We can do better, though. There's very great risk in approaching Dionysus. Just go for a sojourn in Southern California and see. There's an equally great risk in not welcoming him back into one's conscious household, because in his unconscious form, he does a great deal of damage. And Apollo, all by himself, is just as dangerous as Dionysus is. He just has better manners, that's all. It is Apollo who made the atom bomb. It is our rational, cool, logical, Apollonian mind which has finally produced the most dangerous thing the world has ever seen. They're both dangerous, and I propose to go at this very, very cautiously. I've been around the unconscious long enough to proceed with great caution with what everyone is doing, but there are certain things that have to be done. In my opinion, Dionysus must be welcomed back into our household with dignity. And of course it's dangerous, but I feel it's even more dangerous not to. As for the sensation function and the feeling function, I'm using Jungian terminology with this, and they are different faculties. The sensation function is that of the physical world. My appreciation of the thingness of the world is my sensate faculty. And the feeling function, according to Jung, very hard to find a Western term, especially an English term, which is adequate for it. I'm more at home in using the word valuing than I am at feeling. I'm not talking about emotions. I'm talking about that express faculty of giving value to things, which is a different faculty from my appreciation of the thingness of the world. It is in those two senses that I'm using the two words. I think women were very wise in keeping the Eleusinian mysteries secret as they did. They were always performed at night, and I think it's probably wise to keep those things under strict care and control, lest, as you said, they get too dangerous or they just come out and take over the whole world. We don't seem to mind if Apollo comes out and takes over the whole world. We seem reasonably happy with that. But it's true. One must be exceedingly cautious as the Dionysian quality is reintroduced into our society. It's slightly out of context, but let me read a quote from Dr. von Franz about what happens with a repressed quality. She's talking about symbols and dreams here, but it applies directly to what we're talking about. And listen to this indictment which she gives. What if an impulse appeared in a dream as a tiger or a wolf, or in the sense we're talking about as a goat? There a psychic content has been pushed into the body side and perverted so that it is no longer strictly human. When a thing is repressed, it loses its human qualities. If an impulse comes up and is not lived, it is pushed back down and tends to develop anti-human qualities. What should have been a human impulse becomes a tiger or wolf or goat-like quality. That's what's so difficult about Dionysus now. We have him only in a repressed form, and that, by definition, is a poor or a low form. For instance, a man has an impulse to say something nice to someone, but he blocks it through some inhibition. He might then dream he has driven over a child with his car. He has had a spontaneous feeling impulse on the level of a child, but his conscious purpose has smashed it. The human is still there, but as a hurt child. Should he do that habitually for 5 years, he would no longer dream of a child who has been hurt, but as a zoo full of wild animals raging in a cave. An impulse which has been driven back loads up with energy and becomes inhuman. That's the only form that we have Dionysus available in now. It loads up with energy and becomes inhuman. So that's what we're up against. When you've kept something at bay for some time, it will be a raging beast when it first comes out. Of course, it's easy to say, it's better not to touch anything like that, but leave it longer in the dungeon, and sooner or later, when you have to bring it out or it breaks its way out, it will indeed be an inhuman quality. So there's a wonderful thing about the unconscious. If you will turn around, give it dignity, and speak kindly and courteously to it, it immediately quiets down, and the bestiality and the inhumanness of it diminishes rapidly. So if you'll go to Dionysus and give him some dignity, he will give you some dignity and some safety in reply. Women have a great need and a great affinity and devotion to Dionysus. And a woman is almost totally dependent on a man, or at least the masculine principle, to bring the Dionysian quality to her. He is androgynous himself, so he's not just a patriarchal element, but a good mediator between masculine and feminine. And I've observed that if a man will give his woman or mediate for her the Dionysian quality, she will forgive him for almost anything else. So valuable is that quality coming out of a man, that woman will put up with extraordinary things from a man if he is bringing that quality for her. But if he drives that quality up, she will be at him like a battering ram. This is not so much a balancing of masculine and feminine as it is matriarchal or patriarchal, a good way to think of it, I think. The patriarchal quality we know only too well, but it's done good things for us. The Dionysian quality has to come in at least a partly feminine environment. But I can't equate Apollo as masculine and Dionysus as feminine. It doesn't work out that way. There's such a wonderful interplay in our cultural history, Old Testament, New Testament, between sheep and goats. You know how often this turns up in our scriptures. And the sheep is the noble animal and the goat is the devil's animal. Well, the goat, of course, is Dionysus. And this is simply another way of saying that the Dionysian quality is given no dignity and is expelled or excluded. The Jews, in fact, in their enthusiasm to get rid of the Dionysian capacity within them so that the Apollonian and the patriarchal world might triumph, instituted the custom of scapegoating. They would take a goat, Dionysus animal, put all their sins on top of it, and send it off into the desert. Well, somebody has said that this is the age when the scapegoats of history are returning out of the desert for us. You cannot repress anything indefinitely. You can't get rid of a god or an archetype. There's just no way you can get rid of it. You can send it off, scapegoat it for a time while you prepare something else and get it strong. But it will always come back. And the latter part of the 20th century seems to be devoted to the return of scapegoats, principally to Southern California. The sheep is said to be the noble animal. And Christianity has adopted the sheep and the lamb as the animal of nobility. I was delighted to learn that when the Bible was being translated into Eskimo tongue, where, of course, there were no sheep or lambs, the translators were hard-pressed to know what to do. And with some genius, they translated that wonderful line from the New Testament, "O seal of God that takest away the sins of the world." The seal was the nearest thing to a sheep they could find. I was delighted to learn that the sheep became the standard of currency in the Western world. All of our money antecedents, the shilling, the mark, the franc, the lira, the peso, and the taler, the Australian taler from which we get our word dollar, all were the price of one sheep. And there was no inflation in Europe for a long, long time because one knew exactly what one's money was worth in any land or any time. A coin was worth one sheep. But remember, not a goat. Sheep became the currency. Sheep became the stable one. We make our devils pictorially, much like goats. We put horns on them, and of course they have the split hoof. There's something about a goat, even in our culture now, symbolically speaking. People who drink goat's milk are a little curious in this culture. Anything concerning the goat is Dionysian in quality. When one dips down to get an archetype that is 3,000 or 4,000 years old in its repression, one is in for a difficult time. Remember what von Franz said, that something repressed loads up with energy and becomes inhuman. Well, 3,000 or 4,000 years of repression of the Dionysian quality has loaded it up with a great deal of energy and given it a distinctly inhuman characteristic. Many of the Dionysian things which attack us, like alcoholism or the drug world or smoking, seem to have a diabolical power over us. Have you ever watched somebody try to stop smoking? It's hard. The hippie movement is to be explained by the resurgence of Dionysus. Everything that was sacred to Dionysus became high value to the hippie movement and to the flower children. The scapegoats came back. And of course, in such a naive form that it was almost without effect. Except it does have its effect. And a few episodes like that, and experiments, mostly failures, will pave the way for Dionysus to come back for us. As far as I know, this is the only possible way of welcoming him back, probably by a series of failures. In the
rash moment. I once said in a lecture that the story of my life is that I make 2 steps forward and skid back 3, but I'm on my way to heaven because I was headed in the wrong direction in the first place. This seems to be how the Dionysian quality is behaving with us. It's largely a series of failures, but it's working nonetheless. I think I quoted last night for you that when we dismantle Olympus, the gods become symptoms. And that's almost the only place we have Dionysus now in our culture, is in symptomatic form or use. If one's honest enough, he's in for a terrible shock, which will precipitate a crisis upon you if you look. And that is one's devotion to Dionysus in a symptomatic way. One looks at the newspaper page early in the morning, and if you'll be honest enough, you'll see your eye light upon the latest disaster. There's an air crash, or there's been a rape, or a hijacking, or some gory, gruesome thing. And one says, how horrible. But a curious kind of thrill of pleasure goes down the back of one's spine also. This is Dionysus in very poor form in his symptomatic language. And it's a miserable place to pay homage to that worthy god. But it's mainly how he lives these days. A friend took me to an air show in Southern California some years ago. He's wise about things like that. And he says, you know, a crowd like this gets going in its clumsiness and it clamors for blood and it isn't going to stop until something goes wrong. And just then, a little mosquito-like helicopter showing off got too far on one side and crashed and burned right in front of us. There was a gasp of horror, but ecstasy out of the crowd. And he turned around to me and he said, see? The Indianapolis 500 auto race is famous for its fiery crashes. It's hardly ever spoken, but people aren't satisfied until there's been a spectacle somewhere. Well, this is Dionysus in his symptomatic form. Very, very, very poor form of it, but we're nourished by it nonetheless. Or almost nourished by it. I read an amazing observation in the London newspaper. A British doctor had come onto the information that an East Indian in his traditional diet didn't get enough vitamin B12 to keep a rabbit alive. But B12 deficiency was not common in India. He was interested in this. So he went to India to see what this discrepancy of data was. He did the test as best he could, and it's true. People weren't getting enough B12 to keep so much as a rabbit alive, and yet B12 deficiency was not common. And he tested, and he looked, and he thought, and he observed. Couldn't come up with any conclusion. Perhaps the amount of B12 required was different for a Hindu. So he took a Hindu home with him to England, where the laboratories had better equipment for testing, gave the Hindu exactly the same diet in England, and in a very short time, the Hindu came down with B12 deficiency. Well, this was a still further puzzle. And they worked, and they wondered, and they tested. And finally, came to the understanding that there was enough dirt in the food in India to give the necessary B12. And in the clean food of England, the poor man came down with deficiency. There were enough weevils in the flour and worms in the fruit in India to provide just the necessary B12. There's an exact parallel with us now. There's just enough nonsense in our environment to keep Dionysus alive, worms in the fruit and weevils in the flower, so to speak, psychologically. And we're getting by on this bare minimum of ecstatic quality, the terrible headlines, or the car crash down at the intersection, or one's noisy neighbors who have a terrible row on Saturday night, something like that. We are fed illegitimately by this manner, as the Hindus are, with the dirt in their food. If one understands this in one's own psychology, then he is bound to go and do something better than this. Missionaries went into central Mexico, found the natives drinking pulque, a fermented cactus juice, forbade it of them, and they died because it was the only B vitamin that they were getting. One had better be cautious about how one cleans up one's life, because one might just take the weevils out of the flower and not have enough B12 left. This requires high intelligence. Most of all, Dionysus lives in those two awful catch-alls of repression, war and madness. War is a Dionysian ecstatic quality of extremely poor quality. But until we do something better, we probably will have to have our wars. I was impressed of this early in my life. My father was an unhappy man who sat out most of his life. He retired into illness and a kind of dyspeptic quality. But as a child, I observed that once in a while he would bring out his World War I uniform and his eyes would sparkle and he was alive for half an hour. Then the uniform was put back and the fire went out of his eyes and that gray resignedness fell over him again for some months. And then he would bring out his World War I uniform again. There was a half an hour of spark and life in that man. It was the one time he had lived. Better that than nothing, but we can do much better. Anytime one says, "I am bored," he is suffering from Dionysian lack. Dionysus is the exact antidote for boredom. If one finds oneself bored, it's because by dint of much effort, he's kept the Dionysian quality out of his life, and the light has gone out of it too. Just to make it a bit easier for you, I happened on to a more careful and precise delineation of the word sensual. Whenever I make a new advance in consciousness, generally I have to get a more precise vocabulary with which to handle it. And this is one of those events in my life. The word sensual, ending in L, by Webster's Dictionary, is of the properties of pleasure, being base or vicious, a destitution of the spirit. Truly a brutish word. Sensuous, ending in S, luxurious yielding of oneself to pleasure, the realm of the poet or artist, the life of the spirit as seen through the senses. A truly noble word. John Milton was the first to use the word sensuous, that is, the noble aspects of the sensate function. Dionysus is at his best in the sensuous, ending in S, world, but he's often accused of being sensual, ending in L. One must know the difference and have this kind of differentiation available, or he will likely just turn the whole thing off and say it's too dangerous. Two more words were useful to me. A friend once said to me, "Robert, you know, you're the only person I know who ever commonly uses the word joy." Well, I hadn't noticed, but I was interested, so off to the dictionary I go. The word happening means a happening or a chance, luck or fortune. Joy, an exaltation of the spirit, gladness, delight, the beatitude of heaven, or paradise. Or happiness and the pursuit of happiness, which is suspect, because the word comes from the same root as to happen, is a mixed bag, and one knows how fragile is the pursuit of happiness. But joy I equate with enthusiasm. Just listen to that definition of joy. An exaltation of the spirit, a gladness, a delight, the beatitude of heaven, or paradise. The Dionysian quality at its best is a joyous quality and has no backlash to it and is not dangerous. Somehow we have come near the hour again, and it's time to talk about what we have been discussing. What do you think of this? I missed the first word, I'm sorry.
The ghost?
Goat, all right. Mm-hmm. I feel that it's terribly unconscious, and one of those brutish things which gives legitimate Dionysus such a bad name. Almost everything concerned with the goat, even our slang use of the word, is negative. So we give the poor goat a bad name, which makes it very hard then to bring any of the Dionysian goat-like quality back into our culture with any dignity or any intelligence to it. You see what a terrible prejudice we have built up. Oh, goats are for witches to use in their midnight revels and the like, or Freemasonry or something like that. That's only in its repressed, poor, brutish form. And the task that I'm laying out for you now is to bring Dionysus back in his noble form. I think so. Dark-skinned people never made this repression as, at least to the same degree, that white man has. There's an incredible fact to be observed wherever there are minorities. White man projects Dionysus onto dark-skinned man and then resents him for it. We do this with Negroes in America. And in Southern California, there's a large Hispanic population. So the whole Mexican thing carries the Dionysian quality for us. And we love it, and we can't get far away from it, and we appreciate it, and we go to Mexican restaurants. But then we turn around and resent them for their Dionysian quality. A pure duplicity on the part of white man. Yes? Yes, I understand. Well, you must understand that I'm a mere male. And I speak from my own mind and my own experience. I think June Singer is coming to you soon. I agree with you entirely. We're terribly clumsy with this, and I'm being clumsy before you this afternoon. I'm giving you the best I know and the best I have. But of course I look at it from a masculine point of view. And I think I'm going to leave a legacy of a whole basket of things for June Singer. She is very wise on this very subject. And ask her and tell her I leave some unanswered questions in the air for her to grapple with. Okay. You're speaking of sublimation. I was talking about repression, and they're utterly different things. Sublimation requires that the act be done consciously, and there is no limit to sublimation so long as it is conscious. Repression is trying to play as if something were not there and simply stamping it out or stamping it under. And that returns only to make much trouble for one. It's a little bit like the Christian concept of sacrifice. It is said correctly in Christianity that that which is truly sacrificed returns glorified. There is no limit to what one may sacrifice in one's life, so long as it is truly sacrificed and not just repressed. But as Dr. Jung never ceased pointing out, you have to have something in your two hands before you can sacrifice it. Well, a question beautifully put and highly to the point. We have to have a fine differentiation, which we don't yet have, before one can even talk about integration. I'm spending our afternoon trying to search out the differentiation and find out what we have done with Dionysus before we can breathe a word of how we can put Dionysus and Apollo back together again. Indeed, they must be rejoined as a single coin, finally. But we have much work to do before we can make that joining. Somebody complained considerably in my book, The Psychology of Romantic Love, that I was spending so much time trying to differentiate two kinds of love. You have to do your work of differentiation very carefully and completely before you have the right to talk about integration. So mostly we're differentiating this afternoon. I send you home with the noble task of putting it all together. There's such a good example of Eros and Psyche and the final union of the two and the child, delight, which is born between them, from them. Maybe one can do something of the same thing with Dionysus, but the subject is still so raw, it is so new, that the subject matter is not yet differentiated sufficiently to make such a thing. I don't know how to transfer Dionysus over to the Eros and Psyche story. The Muslim world never banished Dionysus. They revel in him. They're not so good at the Apollonian world, though. Well, such an event is one of those awful dichotomies. The Muslim world is saying, we're having a fine time, we're showing them. And we may blow the thing up finally, but wasn't it wonderful? If you can look yourself into the Muslim mind, that's how they would think. The West says, this is terrible, there's no fair play, it's a desecration of property. And they're both right, except they're both clumsy. And I put forth gingerly the possibility that they're equally clumsy. I get frightened when I get into the Muslim world because my values don't hold. I'm not sure that plane is going to come or it's going to get off the ground if it does. I was terrified in Pakistan. Nothing happened, nothing went wrong, but I just felt that I'm in a culture which doesn't respect order and form. I was thrilled, too. Yes, yes. Islam is beginning to understand that it must adopt some of the Apollonian world, and it must at least limit the alcoholic world. With communication what it is now, different ends of the world are beginning to inform each other, and that tempering process is taking place. Slow and terribly clumsy, but nonetheless it's taking place. Here's I have from India is a quote from a Hindu saint. The highest worship of God is simply to be happy. In the definitions we made a moment ago, perhaps he would have used the word joyful, but I understand what he means. India never tore the Apollonian Dionysian apart as we have. And the thickness of that coin, which we have been speaking of, is intact in India. That's one of the great delights of being there. The Dionysian is present in good quality. He obeys proportion. He lives in good quality. He doesn't go to excess. And I marveled at the wonderful differentiated quality of Dionysus, which I found in India. That's principally why I go. I leave here and go to Perth, and then I go to India for my seventh trip to India, just to drink of that wonderful quality, the ecstatic quality, in high differentiation. The word tragedy has generally been translated as goat song, which is very curious and has never meant anything to me. Then recently I discovered a new possibility of the etymology of the word as meaning
the alcohol in the wine. So the tragic aspect of life is that capacity for seeing that which is greater than oneself, or the ecstatic side of life. A day at the theater in ancient Greece consisted of three tragedies, the wine, and one comedy. Masochism is a poor quality of Dionysus. There's another pair of words which is instructive. Enthusiasm, perhaps the most beautiful word in the English language to my ears. The word means to be filled with God, entheism. Enthusiasm, an entirely legitimate term. You have every right to whatever enthusiasm you are capable of. And it will not backlash with you or boomerang and come and hit you with its opposite. Because enthusiasm means to be filled with God. The happiness, the delight, the joy, the sensuousness, this is entirely legitimate. Now, its opposite, inflation, is a miserable term and makes much, much misery. Inflation consists of being puffed up or inflated with one half of a pair of truths. If an archetype gets split and one identifies with one of that pair split off, one will go off in an inflation, a fanaticism. He will simply go off like a rocket. Also, negative inflation is possible, where one gets into a bad depression or ground down by the darkness of life. An enthusiasm is legitimate and will bring life for you. And inflation is always something less than human and will let you down finally. That differentiation is essential. So many people are hunting for an inflation, thinking that that high is the meaning of life. And where can I get something that will buoy me up? Where can I get a kick? Where can I get a high? But an inflation, which every high is, will let you down. It will turn into its opposite before one's finished. But an enthusiasm is that which is beyond pairs of opposites and is an entirely legitimate experience. Where does Dionysus live with us? Several places, generally in symptomatic form. He has an uncanny way of burrowing into your animus or your anima. And much of the overbearingness or too muchness, the fanaticism, which turns up in animus or anima phenomenon, is Dionysus taking up residence in that only half-conscious faculty which animus or anima often is in one. Family fights are often very poor quality Dionysus. If the household has had no Dionysus all week, he will precipitate a family fight to get some worms in the flower and weevils in the fruit as minimum necessary Dionysian nourishment. A young friend of mine, an intelligent young man, came to me. He said, "Robert, I'm at the end of my rope. My girl and I fight every weekend, and we can't stop, and we don't want to fight, but we can't stop it. And every Saturday, Sunday afternoon, things are going downhill, and by Sunday evening, I lose my temper and I beat her. And I'm so guilty, I don't know what to do, but I can't stop it." Well, I recognized the compulsive need for some Dionysus between the two of them. They said, "All right, try an experiment, please." The ceremony did the necessary Dionysian act without anybody having to go through the barbaric experience of beating or being beaten. So they did a Dionysian ceremony every Saturday morning, honored the god, and had a wonderful weekend. I prescribe this for you if you're having difficulty in this way. Most fights can be ceremonialized to very great advantage if the two people will consent to it. Then Dionysus can be had ceremonially. A worship is made instead of a battle is made. And that's all that he requires. Ceremony is one of the most powerful ways of approaching this whole subject, which is open to us. I was invited to lecture at a Roman Catholic seminary once, any subject I liked. The devil got into me, and I did a lecture entitled, Your Neurosis as a Low-Grade Religious Experience. I'm not sure I've ever enjoyed myself so much in all of my life. I had that seminary fairly rocking with the heresies I was putting out. A seminarian came up afterward and he said, you mean to stand there and tell me that those kinky things I do at night and that I'm so terrified somebody's going to find out are a religious experience? I said, God doesn't come to you much of any other way. You might well look there. If you want to find Dionysus in your life, look at some of the kinky things in your life. Look at what embarrasses you. Look at what frightens you. Look at what turns you into an anguish of squirming about when you think of it. Or if somebody else were to find out that detail of your life, how embarrassed you would be. You're probably in the presence of the God. The thing to do is to take those kinky bits of yourself and go and ceremonialize them. And you'll get a flood of energy and joy and true enthusiasm. It's the delight of my life to turn somebody's, maybe my own, symptom into a revelation. You'll never get rid of any symptom of your life until you transform it into something ecstatic in your life. There is no way ever of banishing a symptom. It can only be transformed. I want to talk more about inflations because it's so important. We get inflations in our society instead of enthusiasms, and it's a bad trade. Inflations even come in gigantic collective forms. Maybe the largest inflation that mankind has ever engaged in is still within living memory. That is Nazism. Wotan is the German Dionysus. He's the Norse god of ecstasy. He's called a berserker, which is a German term for what we've been calling the ecstatic one. Well, Germany, that very disciplined, cultured, highly intelligent nation, refused Dionysus or Wotan in any conscious form, so he came bursting, roaring forth in the German unconscious. Dr. Jung first observed it and made note of it publicly in 1921. He said, something is stirring in the German unconscious. Every German patient I have has rummaging through his dreams what Jung at that time spoke of as the blonde beast. He wrote articles of it occasionally, finally identified it in the early 30s as National Socialism, as the Nazi movement. And finally, Dionysus, or Wotan, an extremely poor form in that heaped up with energy and inhuman form, which Nazism was, and was the wreckage of most of Europe. Dr. Jung was particularly interested in this because there are old legends from as far back as the 12th century that the Third Reich would be the salvation of Europe. And it had that capacity. Had the energy of Wotan found legitimate expression, say, in an enthusiasm or an artistry, Europe would have been saved World War II, and it could have been the unification or the salvation of Europe. But instead, it turned into an inflation and was the wreckage of much of Europe. Inflation is like getting drunk. People value this so much and think that life has no meaning unless one gets a high or one gets an inflation. It always brings its opposite and steals away from us the enthusiasm which we might legitimately have. Our culture is so jaded that we ask for inflations. An old name for inflation, more familiar to us, is possession. It's said that enthusiasm annuls the distance between the pairs of opposites. Now, two more terms which are useful too. I have to get proper differentiations in my mind before I can open up a new subject. Whenever I make a new development in myself, I need an expanded vocabulary with which to relate to that development. Induction and conduction is such a pair of terms. This is borrowed from the world of physics and electricity especially. Induction consists of energy coming into a transformer, going through its coils, and going back again where it came from. On the other side of the transformer are some coils, and in those secondary coils is induced an electrical current, which then is useful to us. The transformer, on our end of the scale, is useful for taking the 100,000 volts from the transmission wire and getting it down to the 220 volts, which is useful in our house plugs. Induction consists of one system of energy inducing current into another system, but no energy from the first ever gets into the second directly. Conduction, on the other hand, is some energy from one source flowing directly into another source. Should an induction system break down and turn into a conduction system, there would be 100,000 volts in the plugs in the room, and everything in the house would be burnt up. The parallels to this psychologically are exact. If one relates to the great powers within oneself by way of induction, one is warmed by them, energy is produced, and a controlled energy system is available. No energy from the archetype comes into our personal lives, however. That is forbidden in induction. Should conduction take place, there's a direct line from the archetypal world flooding into the ego-dominated conscious world, and it's as catastrophic as 100,000 volts getting into the floor plugs in the house. And that's exactly what an inflation does. If one takes the stuff of the unconscious raw into consciousness, then one is inflated and he's flying high. And of course, there's damage and there's wreckage as far as one can see. So I'm counseling you, when you touch Dionysus, do it by induction. That is, let him warm you, but don't let him flood into you. Don't make a conduction in which one is swept off one's feet and drunken style goes off into a great fanaticism of some kind. Is that okay with you? Okay. I labor heavily trying to describe these things. Another place to look for Dionysus, a favorite place of his to lodge himself, is in your inferior function. You know Dr. Jung's theory or his model that everybody has four basic faculties in his system, and he brings one of them to a high level of development. That's his superior function. That's where he functions well. He's creative. He's productive. And one of the characteristics is that he doesn't tire quickly at that point in his life. He will take a second function and develop that moderately. It's never so good as the first function, but it's good. It's available to him. If he's a particularly intelligent person, he will take a third function and bring that to a degree of perfection. Not so good as the second function, however. But it's available, and it's a useful, and it's a creative tool. But God help us, the fourth function lies as if submerged in the unconscious and makes a terrible trouble for us. Dr. Jung once said, you don't have an inferior function. An inferior function has you. It's that compulsive thing that leaps out, and before one knows what one has done or said, some destructive or inappropriate thing is jumped out of one. But Dionysus often takes refuge in that fourth function or the inferior function. So if you want to go searching for the Dionysian quality of your life and you have sophistication enough to be aware of what your inferior function is, you will very likely find him precisely there. Wonderful things come out of one's inferior function if one will do it privately and probably ceremonially. If you begin to live out your inferior function, you simply will strew the wreckage of your life through the whole neighborhood. If one can do this privately, one will get the gold from the inferior function assimilated into his life. There's a wonderful mythology that God speaks to us only through our inferior function. So, if you want that God-filledness, if you want the enthusiasm of your life, you probably will have to reckon with your inferior function. But please know what you're doing and have the necessary safeguards to do it, which consist largely of privacy and non-literalism. I had a wonderful dream once, and I was working with somebody who was very wise at the time. My dream was this. It's inferior function stuff and directly to the point. So I tell you this. It's also old enough so that I think I can risk it. I dreamed that a boy had been drowned in a river and we were to search for him. And the only way legitimate to search for him was to search with our feet. So we were out in the river, searching about, pushing our feet about in the mud, trying to find the drowned body of the boy. No one could find him, and I found out that I could go a little farther out into the river if I tipped my head back, which put my nose another quarter of an inch higher so that I could venture a little farther out. And by doing this, I found the drowned boy with my feet. Somehow, I managed to get the corpse up out of the river and into the house without seeing it or without touching it with my hands, using only my feet. And when we had him stretched out on the bed in the house, then we could see. The boy sat up, and he had a golden glow about him, and he began speaking wisdom, as if making a kind of book of Proverbs. We were awed at the splendor and the magnificence of this golden creature, so full of wisdom. There was a stir at the back of the room, and someone whispered, "Here comes his mother, and it's going to be harder on her to find her son in this state than to find him dead." That was the end of the dream. My analyst explained to me that the Christ figure, or the salvation of man, or the contact with God, only comes through one's inferior function, the bottommost part of oneself. This is portrayed in Gothic architecture by the fact that the only official way of entering a Gothic cathedral is through one of the west towers, which is the feet of Christ. The soles of the feet are called that because the soul comes and goes through the bottom of the feet, no place else. It's one of those wonderful word informations which thrills me so much. So, when I'm searching for the Christ child, I can use only my inferior function. My head won't help a bit. In the Gothic building, there is no door in the choir of the church, which is the head of Christ. If you're to have the Christ experience, you must go through the west towers, which are the soles of the feet of the figure of the reclining Christ. You're up against your inferior function if you're asking for enlightenment or for salvation. And that is generally the place of Dionysus in your life. Here was this ecstatic child or boy putting forth so much wisdom, but he could be found only through the bottom of my own feet. Please address the inferior function phenomenology of your life, because it is there that your revelation will come. But do it privately, do it carefully, and do it with the safeguards which are required such an experience. All right, I think we should talk a bit now. Please help me to fill in some of the things that I've glossed over. And I've done that Geminian trick which I am so well capable of. of flooding out a great deal of information before you, but not rounding it out or fleshing it out very well. Let's take some time to do that now. Two levels at least. We have our collective embarrassments, which is our collective shadow or our collective inferior function. So it's likely that all of us in this room would react somewhat the same to a particular event. We are conditioned culturally to do that. And that's a good place to look. Then there are the unique personal embarrassments, each unique to himself. And those probably are the most fruitful places to go and look. Go and look where you're frightened or embarrassed or would squirm with embarrassment if somebody found out. And there you will find Dionysus, quite certainly. Do it privately, please. What is the place of group confession? That's a highly debated issue. And the world is split just right down the middle on this subject. And every introvert you will ever find will say this is an entirely private matter and groups are of the devil. And extroverts will say, now look, this is a communal process and you can go and stare at your navel till the end of time by yourself and you won't get anything. It's not until something is brought out into the social level that it has any relevance or meaning. Well, you know on which side of the scale I am. But that's only my prejudice. If it's of your temperament to go and do something in a group, well, God bless you. You probably need it. If you're an introvert, go off and close two doors and make sure nobody is around and get out your ceremonial things and see what presence of God you can find that way. They both work very well. Yes? How to have a ceremonial fight. Well, it takes intelligent people to begin with. It takes people who are willing and cognizant of understanding of form before you can have a ceremonial fight. I remember one young man who came to me. He was a PhD. They're always very difficult because they're so well trained that their defenses are almost impenetrable. And he was complaining about something. So I said, now look, you've been talking about this for a year and nothing has happened. You sit down on the floor, you take that cushion, and you have a fight with it. And he did. He learned what ceremony was that minute. And he told the cushion what he was going to tell his adversary. And the cushion answered back for him, of course, through his own speech. And he said, and the cushion said, and he said, and the cushion said, and he said, and the cushion said, and wonderful things transpired from that. Now, two people can do this with each other also, as long as they will stay within the ceremonial bounds. No one gets angry, no one gets personal, no one is pushing, and no one may be one-sided with this, though, of course, he will argue his side of the thing. A wonderful, wonderful fights can be had and the energy garnered out of it if two people will make this ceremonial kind of exchange, which always implies or requires a degree of impersonalness about it. And it's such fun when one has gone some distance with a fight to swap sides. And if you have sufficiently impersonal quality, you can do this. And so much energy can be garnered from it. Please go and try.
And the other side of it is a genuine enthusiasm. Would you think that that leads to trying to bring people with you? I'm thinking now of religious enthusiasm. And I'm wondering how to distinguish the genuine article from the inflation.
One litmus test one can bring to this, if there's fanaticism in it, it's inevitably inflation. It's a nice theory, but to bring something from another culture or another religion into our Christianity is very difficult to do. I watch very carefully the experiments that are going on. They're not doing awfully well. But we have much of the Dionysian in our own Christian religion if one wishes to restore it. Do you know that the altar boys used to dance before the high altar? And in the 12th century, one of the popes, Gregory, I think it was, forbade it because it had gotten out of hand, like the Roman Bacchanalia. It was a good thing, but they ran it into the ground. So it was banned. But the Cathedral of Toledo in Spain had kept their dancing within bounds and had kept it something of beauty. And they petitioned the Pope that they might be allowed to continue it since they had not misused it. And the Pope said, you may continue it as long as the present vestments last. The present vestments are still lasting. And on Palm Sunday, before Easter, you may see the altar boys dance before the high altar in the Cathedral of Toledo. These are bits of the Dionysian quality, which are still open to us. I hope you have surmised by this time that Christ is the Dionysian God because he's the wine God. And until so much of that was shorn from him, the Christian religion, until it got sobered so much, was the God of ecstasy, the God of love, and the God of wine. Christ is Dionysus in yet another form. If you want something profound to read, try and get hold of a paper that John Sanford in San Diego wrote called Jesus, Paul, and Depth Psychology. And he addresses this very subject. And he says that the teachings of Jesus are a Dionysian, joyous, happy, enthusiastic quality. St. Paul came along and made it into something else, which Jack Sanford is not entirely happy for. He put this forth first in a sermon at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in San Diego. Thank you for your compliment indirectly to me to pursue my line of thought. If you haven't discovered it by now, thinking is my inferior function. Well, one drinks the wine, which is the blood of Christ, a purely Dionysian experience. And one is to be flooded with joy. One is to find the ecstatic. One is to take the wine and have the vision of heaven. This is not unknown in Christianity at all. Yes? Dionysus is the dismembered God, as was Christ. Christ was thrown into the underworld. He was dismembered and thrown into the underworld and made an epiphany again. Yes. So we have a wonderful Dionysian heritage if we will but take it. I forgot to say somewhere along the way that one of the terrible perversions of Dionysus or misconceptions of him is the drug world. I hear it argued sometimes that the drug world used ceremonially and religiously, as say the American Indians do with peyote, is a legitimate route. I don't know, I'm not sure. I tend to doubt it, but I'm not sure of that. Dionysus gone wrong. Dionysus in extremely poor form. Dionysus as conduction rather than induction. Is it, please?
Is there anything that is not Dionysus?
Yes. The Apollonian thought, where you get out your slide rule and do your mathematical task in the calculus class in the university, is not Dionysian.
Well, maybe something.
Please?
Maybe something.
I would like to reserve that for the god Apollo, who brings a great joy with him too. Finally, all the gods seem to have a common source, and none of these qualities are exclusively reserved for any one of them. But just for some clarity of terminology, let's leave the ecstatic quality for Dionysus and the focused, rational, disciplined faculty for Apollo. But that's just terminology. I think I agree with you. The jester in Dionysus. Dionysus was welcomed into the courts of Europe as the jester or as the court fool. That's one of his disguises. And go and read the speeches of the fool in King Lear, and you'll have a great joy. Let's see, what other things? Mardi Gras is Dionysus Day. Mardi Gras is the day before Ash Wednesday. Mardi Gras means Fat Tuesday. I was doing some fuzzy thinking, for which I apologize. Culturally speaking, Dionysus seems to have taken up residence between our two most inferior functions, sensation and feeling. For an individual, he may find it someplace else, unique to himself. With thinking as my inferior function, I have only to go off in some of my thinking bouts, which I try to keep as private as possible. And I'll get into that ecstatic, Dionysian, often utopian world, which pleases me so much and yields such a poor product. Yes, it's a good experiment. When I began tape recording my things, would do a public lecture. When I heard my first lecture on tape, I contemplated suicide. The ahs in between words, and most of all, the monotony of voice was horribly oppressive. I found out, to my horror, that I spoke within the range of a minor third, the funereal structure. It was horribly monotonous. I couldn't stand myself. So I set to work with my voice to see if I could get a larger range of voice, and I finally got up to a major fourth, third, and then finally a fourth. And I think now sometimes I'm within the range of a fifth. My Mexican friends range in an octave. Well, these are interesting experiments. One bargains a lot in India, and it's impossible to bargain without sign language or body language. So some element of that has come into my character too, to my advantage. Many things to experiment with. Yes?
Before you said you weren't sure about how to view the drug culture, but were the religions in the past, like the Indian with Soma, have actually identified a specific drug with its effect, identified that with a god or being a god? For them, would you say that would, in fact, be the source of their enthusiasm, the god within? And for them, it is genuinely religious?
I've heard it argued that there is a peyote archetype in the American Indians, and that their use of peyote thus has a form and would be comparable to our use of wine and is legitimate. I tend to think that, but I've also heard from the same source that white man does not have a peyote archetype and has nothing to affix this to, and he shouldn't touch it.
The culture?
Yes.
In the object itself?
Yes. I'm puzzled about this, and I don't have a last word to say on it. I'm mostly horrified with the drug world as I see it and the use that's made of it. It's an illegitimate way to get to a legitimate place. So it's 5 o'clock. I think I should say goodbye to you.
We hope you enjoyed Robert's workshop on Dionysus, where he explored the opposing ideals of the mythological brothers, Dionysus and Apollo, and ultimately how they can live in harmony, supporting one another. Robert encourages us to bring Dionysus from the shadows with dignity. In C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne news, our popular annual Jungian Core Concepts course for 2024 is starting soon. Over 8 virtual sessions, Jungian training analyst Annette Lowe will explore concepts including a map of the psyche, psychological types, the journey of individuation, archetypes, and dream analysis. This course does not require any previous training and is recommended for people who are new to Jung's work and those seeking to refresh their knowledge and fill in any gaps. Further information can be found on our website under courses. Thank you to our listeners, and we hope to welcome you in a live lecture or course soon. You can find our monthly lecture topics and further information about our courses on our website at jungsocietymelbourne.com. And we invite you to sign up for our complimentary newsletter for regular updates. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn.